Hey, it's time for Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit, and I'm Dr. Lisa. How you guys doing? Did you miss me last week? You know what? I went to Mexico City by myself. That's right. I ditched my husband, and I went by myself. There were a bunch of art fairs. I went to 5 art fairs. It was really liberating, because I think it's really important, ladies, don't let people take over your life. Make sure you can travel and do shit by yourself, no matter what, and prove it, you know, because if you don't do it regularly, you could wind up being like too dependent on some idiot guy, and then your life will suck. Okay. It's that simple, isn't it? And then I just want to say thanks to Christopher Albert last week, the host of the Junk and Jam Hour, because he filled in for me. I'm going to post his show, and it was really good. He actually took this therapy idea pretty seriously, and I learned some stuff from listening to it about therapy. So thank you, Christopher. Lovely, lovely RFB host. I have a great guest here today, somebody who I am really like honored to have, Adrian Truscott, who's an incredible performer. So stick around. I'm going to get to that in a minute, but I got to tell you about our fundraising drive. Okay. Cause this is super important. Folks, we need money. We need money bad. I mean, seriously, like this isn't funny. But we are making it easy for you to donate, because we have this great Drive to 5 fundraising campaign because we're going to be 5 in May, 5 years and I'm a founding member. I've been doing this for fucking 5 years. This is my 224th show. Can you believe that? So anyway, I would love it if you would go to radiofreebrooklyn.org/drive-to-5. And you know what? If you donate money, we have these really amazing t-shirts. I designed the one that looks like the Chanel bottle, but there's some really great t-shirts if you donate money. So, okay, now back to the important stuff. My guest, Adrian Truscott. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about her, and then we're going to get right to her. Adrian is an incredible artist, performer. She has synthesized a huge variety of skills. She's a choreographer, a circus acrobat, a dancer, writer, storyteller, and comedian. I'm serious, folks. She has really been able to put all these skills together and come up with amazing shows that are, well, first of all, very smart, very thoughtful, but also really fucking entertaining and really, really funny. And I saw a recent show of yours,
Wild Boar.
I'm like trying to remember, but it was hilarious. This is why I thought of asking her on. I was like, I have to have this person on. So it's basically about, she can tell you, but it's theater critics at a dais, and they each have microphones like theater critics, but they're actually like talking asses. And I mean like literally real asses. And it was just so brilliant and so hilarious. And I can't say enough good things. It's really hard for me to communicate, because her work is very, very original. But she has won a bunch of, she's got a lot of credentials, and I just want to put them out there, and then I'm going to turn it over to her, okay? Just because she's not going to brag the way I am going to brag about her. So she was one of the first recipients ever of the Doris Duke Impact Artist Award, the 2017 Foundation for Contemporary Arts grantee. She won a huge award at, I have this written down, Comedy Award Panel Prize, which is huge in Edinburgh. And she's also, here's some more stuff. She's also taught, like, here's stuff you, She's taught at Wesleyan Dance Department, Sarah Lawrence College Theater and Dance Department, and Yale University. I can't, you know, look it up yourself, folks. She's like really killed it. So hi, Adrienne.
Hi, Lisa. I'm like a quintuple non-threat.
That's very funny. That's very funny and very self, you know, deprecating. But can you kind of like put it more gracefully than I have what your work is and what it's about and the skills that you employ? Can you tell us?
Sure. I guess like I learned officially like how to make performance as a choreographer from some really amazing people. And so
you studied dance.
So I studied dance and choreography at Wesleyan with some really amazing teachers. And I also studied with Deborah Hay, who's a performance maker from Judson Church era days.
Oh, wow. So you went to college and you were like, I'm going to be a dancer?
Yeah. I mean, I did the like, I'll move to New York and we'll see what happens for sure. And I guess like since then, I did start making dance pieces originally that were very much using like people who weren't necessarily trained dancers, a lot of pedestrian stuff. And then over time, I feel like I still stick with live performance as my favorite version of art making.
Mm-hmm. And what is
But I think part of the reason I've been in so many different disciplines as sort of different as circus or stand-up comedy is because I just get ideas and then the ideas sort of tell me what might be the most interesting way to play them out. Mm-hmm. And if it's, you know, if it's stand-up comedy, even though I didn't like do stand-up, that doesn't obliterate it as an option. And I find that like switching contexts is a really fun way to figure out things and get new things out of performance and also a way to survive.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of influence did you have like growing up? Was it dance? Was it, you know, like what mediums were you like? What were your interests like in high school? What did you do?
I was always a really deeply physical person. Like I was as a kid, I was always like, you know, flipping over the couch as a way of like getting through the living room or whatever, climbing trees, all of that stuff, which explains to me why I did like sports and gymnastics and dance.
Mm-hmm.
As an older person looking back, I also know that like I think I grew up in a family where it wasn't that easy for me to speak out or up or at all.
Did you feel silenced? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, yeah. I think there were a lot of other people talking, and so maybe my form of expression took something silent, which then became physical.
Oh, that's so interesting. So in order to like have your voice, in order to like make it work with your family, you had to do something besides use your literal voice to get attention?
Maybe, yeah.
Did that work?
I think it was more like in order to make it work for me, I was more like, I'll just go over here and do this.
Oh, so you would say, you would express yourself, but in your own way by yourself or something like that.
Yeah.
But you weren't part of the theater group or anything like that.
No, like my best friend and I put on, you know, living room shows with a degree of rigor and commitment, regardless of attendance. So there was always that little spark of like, would this be a funny or absurd thing to do? And I did, I have to say, even as a kid, the bold choices I may be known for now were present very early on.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like, I always thought it was funny to run through a room naked, still do.
Really?
Yeah.
Like what? Like
cheap thrills to like.
You mean like at a party or with your family? Or?
Yeah. Yeah, like
all
I did.
That?
Yeah, a little bit. Like, I remember one time there was my father was a professor and he had students over. It was the 70s. There were, you know, like very exotic looking people to me, ladies smoking pipes and a guitar was about to come out. Mm. And then I got sent to bed and I was like, you gotta be kidding me. How can I have to go to bed now? And I took that opportunity to do like a quick streaking routine. And I don't know if that was like,
you mean, oh, so you came out naked and your dad was teaching or had these students over and you just ran out into like the living room naked?
Yeah.
That's
I did
cool.
a dance. It wasn't like I just, you know, like I did a little, I did what I thought was a number.
You gave them something.
Kind was, of knowing that was, I would be escorted immediately back to my
and
room.
How did your dad react to that?
I think my dad probably laughed. Like, I don't really remember.
Oh.
I know my mother was like, right, into bed. You're supposed to be to bed.
But they
so I think I got a laugh.
So they weren't
Jesus,
horrified
so.
And punished. They didn't go like, you're naked, kid. What's wrong with
right,
you?
Right, no.
Oh, my God.
It wasn't that.
You didn't horrify. So you had some level of, you know, there was some understanding there or appreciate. There was a little bit of appreciation.
Yeah. No? Yeah. Something.
I think that's pretty fucking cool. My parents would have been like, you know, sent to a boarding. I don't know what.
Yeah. I mean, I also with my friend that we made, we did a, she moved into a house that had a pool one summer. Mm-hmm. And so we thought like, oh my gosh, this is, you know, it's like when Cirque du Soleil did their water show. We were like, oh my gosh, this opens up whole new field of opportunities. And I remember really, and I think we were like 7 or 8, you know, maybe just at that age where it's not just cute mm-hmm. to be a little naked girl, but we thought it still was.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't have matching outfits. And of course, we didn't have a budget to accomplish that. And it, I remember it really striking me like, if we don't wear anything, we'll match. And that seemed important enough.
Yeah.
That was really, it wasn't like, it'll be hilarious to pop out naked at the time. That felt like a considered artistic decision. But it was the neighbors and her parents were kind of like, Jesus Christ. I think that was the first time I felt like I might be inappropriate.
So, because the reaction
was
you got.
It wasn't so appreciated.
They didn't get it. They
no.
didn't get it.
No.
But, you know, it's interesting because I think it seems to me the way you use nudity now, it's not in a sexual context. It's in sort of a practical or pragmatic
yeah.
or to make a certain point.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Which is, so you were on to that pretty young. What kind of student, like, were you a good kid in high school? Did you get good grades? Did you take drugs? Were you bad, good, in between? What kind of kid?
I was a shy kid, but a good kid. I did sports and sometimes, you know, got awards at the end of the season. I generally got straight A's up until high school, and then I was still a good student, but I went to a really, you know, one of those high schools that seems like a good high school and it's fucking awful.
I mean maybe that's just all
high schools, but
yeah,
really bad. And I actually feel like it made me dumb. I think I came out of high school considerably less connected to, you know, like it just wasn't really celebrated. So I got into sports more.
Oh, you mean because they weren't there wasn't a lot of intellectual curiosity. You seem you've always been very intellectually curious. Did you read a lot and stuff like that?
Yeah. And I do think I think that's what I remembered realizing sometime after I left high school, like something crushed my intellectual curiosity.
Ooh, interesting.
I'm sure it was that school that I went to.
So you went to Wesleyan mm-hmm. and then did that. That's a really good school. And your father was a professor there, right?
Yeah. Before I went to Wesleyan, I went to American University on a field hockey scholarship.
Wow.
So I chased a ball for 3 years.
Wow.
And then dropped out after 3 years when I was supposed to just like go back and be the captain of the field hockey
team.
Wow.
What happened there?
All kinds of life-changing things, good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
And then also just like accidents. I sort of like, I think some plans I made to try to have a cool summer fell through. And I ended up spending the summer actually in Middletown, Connecticut, but it wasn't my plan. Mm-hmm. And I met a lot of Wesleyan students there, which gave me a view very different from being like a faculty brat. And I also got a job teaching at a very sort of bread and puppet type circus.
Oh.
And that, I feel like that was a real turning point of like, I met these sort of, you know, dancer, really smart, amazing people from Wesleyan and then loosely connected to Wesleyan through this circus. And I think it was that moment that I sort of thought like, if I go back to college and chase a ball for one more year, that's it for me. But if I drop out, it's going to be major. I may never be able to afford to finish because I was on a scholarship. Right. But I feel like if I don't stay with these, with whatever, you know, just turned me on here. In hindsight, I will also say I would never have clocked this at the time, but it was also about a year after I had been raped. And I understand now that kind of upheaval, you know, I'm dropping out of college. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just going to go here and there and everywhere is, you know, for those of us lucky enough to go to college and unlucky enough to have been assaulted, that kind of, you know, the bottom dropping out and you think you're making decisions about, you know, like college, or maybe I'll teach circus one day, which it turns out, but you know, but actually the changes are coming from this like landscape of trauma that you don't really understand.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to underestimate the impact that could possibly have.
Sorry, was that too much?
No. I'm going to have to.
Okay.
I mean,
we'll circle back.
I'm going to have to ask you about it, of course.
I just meant for your audience.
They're fucking crazy people. Okay. They have no boundaries. I have no boundaries. I mean, that's one thing we must have in common. So the thing is that I'm thinking about like the kind of women that you must have been around as an athlete, and then like they probably weren't your people, and then so naturally you would have been drawn to the people who, like, I could see how circus people would suit you so well because there's a lot of intelligent people. You know, the founder of the station graduated from Clown College.
Oh, really?
Tom Tenney. Did you know that?
Oh, no.
You know Tom?
I don't know him, but I know the name. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So there's a lot of very, you know, makes perfect sense. So, that's bad that you were raped.
Yeah. No. It wasn't ideal.
So so let's just find out about that.
Sure.
So, okay. We're talking like your senior year in college. Well, one of the things that I did want to ask you today was about your feelings about men, because here's what I want you guys to know, people. Is that I personally think that Adrian has like such an awesome, positive view about being female. It's very, I don't want to say liberated, but I find a lot of women, you are very, I think, very perceptive, or you get to the heart of things about feminism or how women, about men and women. And you're very direct about it and you're very funny about it. And I think that your voice is very honest and you're very neutral about sexuality, I think, in the way that it's something that we all do, but sexual currency isn't part of what you're selling. Like you're naked, but you're not trying to be sexy. Mm-hmm. Not that you aren't. And I personally really appreciate that type of attitude. But so I wanted to ask you a lot about your feelings about sexuality. But so that is something that I just want my listeners to know. Even though I wasn't very articulate about it, it is a very interesting and very forthright and smart way to present yourself as a woman. I think you do a great, great, great job of that. And I don't see enough of that, frankly. So I really respect you that way. So, yeah. So let's hear about the rape.
Well, I could put it in a context jumping off of what you were just talking about, which is I feel like, you know, I had an awareness as a young, from the youngest age I can think of being not male in the world.
Huh.
I had a lot of examples. I mean, I think anybody who's not male or male presenting has a lot of examples that keep telling them you're not this. You don't get this power. You don't get this. And so I think, and my body was part of the ways I learned that, like as an athlete, as a dancer, as a gymnast, as a person who was really strong, but still.
I was going to say that. Do you think that your interest, your talent in sports made you much more aware of your body and the way that it was like limited, say, from or you know, separated from being a male body? Do you function different, you know, didn't have the strength of a man or?
I mean, a lot of this stuff is stuff I'm still unpacking because I know that I've always found strength and confidence in what my body can do when I am in charge of what it can do. And I still don't entirely understand, you know, how I'm also a person who found myself in the scenario where I was, you know, my body was totally trespassed.
Right. Did you compete? Did you have feelings about competing with men in sports that you could or couldn't? Was that part of what were your feelings about that?
I mean, I played sports because I loved sports and I definitely have like that version of a competitive streak. And I did gymnastics because I loved all of what you could do. I liked flipping, I liked flying and balancing and but I was a really tiny kid and super strong just because like I was doing literally 100 chin-ups at the behest of the mad witch that was our gymnastics coach, a pretty horrible woman. But so I was really strong and wiry, but I was tiny and I got, you know, I did get like bullied a lot and thrown around a lot in school and that sort of thing. And at the same time, I was like, I was a really fast runner. I had this like upper body strength that most, I guess, girls, you know, aren't encouraged to have. And I remember sometimes when I would like beat boys in a race, I would get punished for it rather than celebrated. My teachers would make excuses out loud for the boys so that they didn't feel weird about being beaten by a girl. But at the same time, I also remember I organized a kickball strike amongst the girls in the sixth grade because I was mad that we weren't that it wasn't an option for us to be team captains, especially since some of us were much better than some of the boys in the class.
Oh, wow. That,
I mean, in sixth grade, so I clearly had issues around like,
well, that makes me so angry just hearing about it. That's a level of repression that I'm not athletic enough to have even endured. That's terrible. Wow.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, it's terrible and also predictable and average behavior,
it makes
right?
Sense.
But
yeah.
But I did, you know, that's what I mean by like from a very young age I had a sensitivity to those perceptions of sort of, you know, injustice with a small I around gender.
Right. So you were in those situations because of your talent, really.
Yeah.
So then what happened?
I spent a few years trying to be adventurous and make adventurous choices about how I spent, you know, my time and my summers in between college. And on one summer, I did not grow up with tons of sort of a sustained custodial attention.
So you were monitored closely?
No.
You monitored? Well, you were, because you're no trouble. You were a good student.
Yeah, I was a good
kid.
You were
athletic. You were winning scholarships. Yeah. No problem. No one had to think about you.
Yeah.
I get it.
Like my last 2 years of high school, I kind of lived by myself.
Because?
It's a little bit complicated, but my mom got offered a good job.
Your parents got divorced, right?
So yeah. So I had a single mom, and she got offered a job that took her away a little bit more than might be.
So she had to travel and she trusted you and left you alone.
Yeah.
Which was maybe not, who knows?
Yeah.
But that's where she was.
Yeah.
That's where she was
so,
at.
And so anyway, with the, you know, the circumstances around me being assaulted.
And wait, let me just, I'm sorry. Like when she left you alone, would she travel for like a week at a time? Are we talking overnight? Are we talking a month?
Variations on all of that.
Like maybe a month like she would leave you?
No, like she would come back on the weekends and, you know, she
You'd be home Monday through Friday alone without your mom? That's a lot. That's a lot. For weeks at a time?
Yeah.
I don't know. Calling child services.
No, you can't say that. That would be upsetting to my mom to hear.
Well, you know, you know me, I'm a fake shrink and I'm just judgmental.
Yeah. No. I mean,
look, you got a scholarship, obviously, no harm done there.
Yeah.
So anyway, you had some time.
Yeah.
She wasn't around all the time.
So I don't think I always had the best the best decision making at my disposal. Mm-hmm. And but anyway, that said,
kids get into trouble with or without their parents around.
I spent I went to Martha's Vineyard and was having what felt like a very independent, exciting, brand new, adventurous summer. And one of the participants in that had his own adventure.
Mm.
And
so it was somebody you knew.
Yeah, not very well.
But somebody you knew. It was somebody that you had to see again?
A tiny bit, but I split. Like,
After that happened,
I wasn't
really
naming it as that, but I left within like the Martha's Vineyard and went on a weird journey for like,
Did you tell anybody? Did you talk about it?
Mm-mm. Not for a long time.
So there were no consequences to the boy?
No.
Whatsoever?
Nope.
And did you process it or were you just like, I have to get out of here?
I have to get out of here. But like, I can recognize, I knew in the moment that this was not like, I was not leaving by choice. Like shit had gone down, but I wasn't naming it that. Mm-hmm. But like, I was waitressing and painting houses. I went to those jobs, you know, and then had my bag packed. I ran out on my rent.
So you just left immediately, like the next day or something like that, really quickly.
Yeah.
And did you feel guilty? Did you blame yourself or were you mad? Do you have any idea or were you just numb?
I think I was numb. Mm-hmm. I didn't blame myself. Mm-hmm. I didn't blame myself. I don't know. I certainly don't blame myself from this vantage point.
Yeah. I hope so.
I think I maybe.
Otherwise you're going to have to come back for like ever.
Yeah. I maybe felt like a bit dumb, you know, at the time. And I definitely felt utterly, dislodged. Like I walked in the dark to one of the ferries, like with my bag and was like, I'm out. Like, it's like, I knew some things like nothing that happened here is okay. And it all needs to be over. So I'm going somewhere else.
Wow.
But like where the somewhere else was going to be was a little up for grabs at first. Well, I actually ended up going on a 6-week cross country trip.
Like in a car?
In a car, yeah. With an ex-boyfriend.
Oh.
Yeah, I definitely did like some like somebody save me moments. Mm-hmm. You know, it didn't occur to me to go home to my family.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow that felt, I think going on, I mean, it all felt very of my age. You know, I was 19, everything was dramatic anyway.
Yeah, of course.
That was certainly dramatic and traumatic.
Did you tell?
I think the the ex-boyfriend happened to be driving cross country. He didn't. He didn't know what had happened to me.
Oh, you didn't tell him?
But he suddenly was like, do you want to come on this trip? And I think that certainly felt like a victory. You know, like, yes, I do. I would much rather, I would rather go and sort of kid myself that I was leaving something that wasn't cool to go on an amazing cross-country trip across America. Felt much more triumphant than, you know, going home and dealing with what had just happened to me.
I find that personally, I find that very impressive. Like, you didn't curl up in a ball, you know, you went out and like did something really like proactive, and you know, no one in your position has the tools to process that at all.
Yeah, like I didn't have any
money. What are you going to do?
Yeah.
So yeah, good job. So was that, did that change? That sounds like a life altering experience.
Yeah.
And, are there specific ways that you see it affected you, or does it?
I think, you know, I think it affected me on every single level, I think, of who I am and who I would become. It has provided probably all of, you know, a number of the struggles or limitations in my life, as well as maybe some of the reasons that I've gone on to find ways of expressing myself.
What do you mean by struggles and limitations?
I think that, you know, trauma affects different people in so many different ways, and also in so many similar ways that I think we're finally really starting to learn about in a way that is spreading into some kind of eventual mainstream understanding of, like, you know, I think Christine Blasey Ford giving the world the phrase the hippocampus, and just like understanding, you know, how long it can take different brains and bodies to accommodate and process that information. Some of us don't do it until we can, you know, some, like, I feel like I did a lot of things to make my life a life I wanted to live. And like a life that would make me happy. And then once that was established, there was space for me to process that more.
That makes a lot of sense.
But I, you know, that was something that I did, but I also know, you know, the unbelievably sad, difficult polar opposite of that, where people are utterly paralyzed. And, you know, they say, some of us like stop developing at the age of our trauma.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like imagining
totally,
like not even realizing that on some level you're still 19.
Oh yeah. I mean, it makes a lot of sense.
It's certainly like the empathy I have for people who've gone through that or other traumas that are of that nature or that level. You know, like, I think there's, when I say things like limitations, like, I think some of the stuff I'm not good at in terms of organizing my life or eliminating chaos from my life comes from that. And I think a lot of people who have been through stuff like that have things that are perceived as personality traits, you know, like, oh, like you forget your keys, or you never know where your phone is, or you can't show up to things on time. And I think a lot of that is, you know,
Changed? I mean, were you somebody that like knew where your keys were, and then after that you didn't?
No, I never did. And I still don't know where my keys are.
So I mean, that seems like that's something that maybe you were anyway.
I guess in my case, maybe one begot the other a little bit. Like there was a lot of chaos for me growing up, and a lot of dislocation, and living different places, and not always knowing who to trust and who not to trust. Around the adult, some of the extracurricular adults in my life,
right? So when you were growing up.
Yeah.
So this kind of cemented problem. Yeah. I mean, what I was going to ask you really was about trust. Like, did it hurt you trusting men, people?
People, men, probably. It's not something, I don't really experience that particular
and like, you are
unwillingness to trust or unwillingness to open up, obviously.
And she's in, I just want you guys to know, she's in like a long-term healthy relationship. You do a lot of work with your partner and a man.
A guy, a dude.
So
a nice
like,
dude.
You know, she's got it together. But it must have made you feel vulnerable in a way, or I'm guessing it made you feel vulnerable in a way, especially somebody who's so physically confident, has earned that physical confidence in a way that you might not have felt before.
Maybe. I think it was probably more confusing because it didn't match with, you know, being someone that could happen to didn't match with the version of a person I was trying to be. You know, I do feel like getting into performance and making work has been a huge, without always making work that was explicitly about dealing with that. I do think that like performing on a stage in front of an audience is a way of being in charge of how your body and your behavior are deployed on your own terms. That's all, speaks to a bigger project that's not unrelated to that.
Yeah. And I could see how that was sort of forming in you naturally, and that it's like another thing that added into the mix. But I do think that like there's so much messaging in your work. And I am really curious to know more about what you are, like the themes that you are conveying and where, you know, where they're coming from and what you are, you know, trying to convey. You talk.
I think I try to convey different things at different times and with different genres, but certainly the last couple of pieces I've made are more explicitly about gender politics. The show I made, Adrienne Truscott's Asking for It, was a stand-up comedy about rape, which was a little bit of a...
It was really funny. Why don't you explain it quickly?
Yeah, I had the idea that it would be a... I mean, this was back in 2013, so like pre-Nanette, and I think it just felt like a clever trick. Like
it was a huge hit.
I would like to, you know, rage about some things that I don't hear talked about, or I hear talked about in such incorrect and ridiculous terms that I want to say something. But I also am smart enough to know that like women railing against stuff are not always heard. And I thought like, I like being funny. I like provocation. And in some ways, stand-up comedy is the least likely platform to talk about sexual assault. And therein lies the trick of the success of combining them. That it would allow, that if I could pull that off, that if I didn't pull it off, it would be a fucking disaster. But that if I could pull it off.
And you did.
And I did.
Big time.
It would be a much more interesting way to sneak that information into less suspecting places.
Which is pretty fucking brilliant. So what you did was you took a lot of rape jokes, right?
Yeah.
Can you explain that? What you did with the rape jokes?
You know, the whole, I mean, now we're a little more used to looking at the term, unpacking the term rape jokes, but there were so many things. I just thought like, of course it will, to me at least, it will never be funny to joke about the act or to joke about the victimization. While we heard tons of dudes at the time actually making that joke over and over and over and over and over and over and over again.
Like Daniel Tosh.
All those dudes. Yeah.
Yeah, all those idiots.
And it was always, I mean, there were many things about it that, so first and foremost, I was like, there is much to critique and satirize around this topic from a very different angle. You know, even though there's nothing funny at its core, you can satirize the perceptions of masculinity around that.
Right.
In a way that was, you know, a circus of possibilities to me. And it was sort of fascinating to me that our misogyny is so internalized that nobody could even imagine you could make a different joke about it that wasn't at the expense of victims. And right. that in and of itself seemed right. like a dire situation.
Right.
You know, I had people who, you know, I certainly made that show and knew I could, quote, joke about it with a place of authorship that I would be allowed mm-hmm. in that comedy rule way of like, mm-hmm. maybe you can get away with a joke about something pretty dangerous if you have like a first person relationship and you're punching up, right?
Right, right.
You know, at the same time, it made me just like sort of annoyed that so many dudes were making so many of basically the same joke and yet calling themselves edgy. And I was like, it's literally not edgy if you're all making the same joke, you guys.
So you actually redid those jokes yourself, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think I just had my own jokes coming mm-hmm. about it because I think I did, you know, sometimes cleverly and appropriately and sometimes inappropriately use humor to, you know, dispel tension or heal or all those things.
But it was it mostly, I mean, I saw parts of it, but was it mostly stand-up?
Yeah, it's an hour of stand-up.
It was all stand-up.
Yeah, right? I mean, I also didn't wear pants, which was, of course, like a whole other layer to it and how it was received.
But, yeah, I mean, it got a huge, huge amount of attention. And that was like, you wrote all that, obviously.
Yeah.
So was that like the first time you did stand-up professionally like that?
Yeah.
So was that insane?
I think so. I mean, as part of the, as a half of the Vow Vow Sisters, which is our like comedy cabaret circus thing, which for us, for me and Tanya Gagné, we just, for that whole project, just gave ourselves license to do anything that we thought mm-hmm. would be funny mm-hmm. or interesting to us, whether mm-hmm. we could do it or not. Mm-hmm. So I had a pretty solid amount of time on stage being funny with my mouth.
Right. You know? And you're obviously great at relating to an audience. And that's what I think is most important in any performance,
yeah, but,
right?
You know,
the ability to relate to an audience in a way that.
But the bravery and security and the tennis match of having a partner on stage.
Right.
To volley and then go to the audience is a very different. It's very different than solo stand-up.
You made yourself really, really vulnerable.
And
so how was that? That must have been like, well, what comes to my mind is how healing that must have been.
Yeah, totally.
Like, but what was that like? Like, was it, what did that feel like?
I mean, it felt like lots of different things. Like, for one, I just was very eager to see what it was like to do a solo mm-hmm. and to try stand up, even separate from, you know, the sort of absurdity of the project.
Mm-hmm.
As a performer, as an artist, I don't think I would have made a show like that 10 years mm-hmm. earlier. Like, I do think I knew that I was in a mature enough place as an artist to pull mm-hmm. that off at mm-hmm. no great risk to myself mm-hmm. or my career, that I would do it. I would do it right. And it would therefore succeed. I wasn't just like a too young artist trying a too big idea without the chops to pull it off.
You were ready for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was really thrilling.
It must have been. And did you feel like you were able to exorcism, whatever that word is, get rid of some of that, or like process some of the feelings that you had from the trauma that you went through?
I think so. I mean, it didn't, I never went on stage with that agenda.
Right.
You know, like I was just doing a show that I thought was really smart, that definitely had some personal urgency, but mm-hmm. It's not, you know, it doesn't behave like an autobiographical show.
Right. It's,
But it's not lost on me that like standing up with no pants on and a microphone and getting to say whatever you want for an hour is probably healing for somebody who, when they said no, wasn't hurt at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like, you know, what the, you know, incident along with what you went through as like an athlete and a lot of other things, you know, it isn't one, it isn't just like what one thing. It seems like you're somebody that's very physical, and what it really means to be like, it's really funny to be a physical female and be, you know, a small stature as at the same time, because it's like you're so powerful and you're so in your body, but then at the same time, you still have all that vulnerability because you're female and you're short.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
it puts you in a weird situation in society, right?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, I can look at all kinds of my physicality from very different logics that I think all collide and make sense. Like, I think I got into circus because I was always like a little monkey. Like, I could always flip upside down, try a trick off a diving board, and it would be all right, you know? And I think it seemed fun. Like, my body loves doing that kind of stuff. Circus is so much cooler than gymnastics because it, like, the politics around it are much cooler. There's all different body sizes required.
Yeah,
all
gymnastics
different skill levels.
Is terrible for girls.
Yeah, gymnastics.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. We got.
Were you subjected to that stuff? Like being the right, wearing those girly outfits. Did you resent that, or what was that like?
I don't think it was a great fit for me.
Yeah,
yeah.
You're just not like that.
Not really like that. But I loved to do the tricks, and I loved the other, you know, my girlfriends who also did the tricks. But so on the one hand, I think I did circus because it was fun. It was in, it's a thing you practice in community. It's like glamorous to be on a trapeze.
Yeah, of course.
You know, it's like, and I can also recognize that, like, there are things about that, like, physicality that involves danger and risk, but you're in charge of it. And it's celebratory instead of traumatic. You know, I can see that there are probably those narratives embedded in some of those choices too. And I do feel like when I was younger, the art I made was, I think the words that would be maybe too easily used were like, it was slightly more abstract. It was certainly more distanced from my making was a little more random. And as I get older and maybe, maybe better at my craft, and maybe know myself more, I am more willing to be more forthright about what I'm making and why, when it serves me. Like, I don't always like to make work that's like, I'm going to, like with Wild Boar, like, why is the rule that you can't talk back to your critics? And like, what, how does that function? And does that function in my favor as a, you know, feminist who makes queer experimental work? Does it function in my favor not to talk back to a body of critique that maybe isn't interested in seeing the work that me and other people do? That's not actually serving me. So I feel smart enough at this stage in my making to collaborate with the right people to make a very clever piece to dismantle that and to talk back on our behalf about our own art.
Because critics, I mean, the authority that critics have, anybody in any creative field, we all know what critics, the role that critics play.
Yeah.
And it's horrible. Some of it's good and some of it's bad, but it creates politics.
Yeah. And like the marriage of genuinely engaged critique with work is amazing and important and incredible and benefits the maker, the critic and the audience.
Right.
But when that exchange is shortchanged by embedded misogyny and racism and homophobia, then that exchange limits the artist and the audience incredibly.
Right. And you're right. Like, no one ever stands up to those people because they're afraid.
Well, and it also, you know, as an artist, you run the risk of sounding like you're complaining.
Or bitter. Or like, and not getting enough.
Yeah. And I feel like when we made Wild Boar, and I made that
piece
with, thank you for coming. with Ursula Martinez, who's a London-based maker, and Zoe Coombs Marr, who's Sydney-based. And we met each other at all these different festivals doing our weirdo work and succeeding enough to survive and also dealing with this very, you know, these particular trends in critique around female experimental weirdo work. And eventually we were like, let's just fucking do it. Especially because, you know, we're, I mean, Zoe's in her 30s, but we're all accomplished enough.
You're all accomplished.
And especially doing it as a trio. Nobody was going to be able to say, like, that's pathetic. Right. No one gets or cares about their work. Shut up.
Were you able to get the message out in a way that you found satisfying, or did you get any, you know, did you get any? I did read one critic that I read something about your show in New York that was really interesting, written by a critic. But did you get, you got some good feedback, or how did that?
Yeah, we've gotten great feedback. I mean, I think it felt good to all of us to just say it and be like, that's what we think about what you don't understand. You actually don't understand it sometimes.
We're actually able to get something done and communicate to the critics.
And
I
some
think,
critics,
right?
Yeah. And, you know, we've gotten review. I mean, overall, the reviews have been great for that show.
Yeah.
We've also gotten them across the board for all the reasons that the show is about.
Right.
We've had some critics who have jumped into the game that we played with that by giving us like extraordinarily florid, gruesome language that's just hilarious, and then giving us 5 stars as well.
Oh, that's, I love that.
You know, like really playing the same game that
So it's got a meta aspect where you really did have that kind of, like, you did have the satisfaction of having that kind of drawing in the critics and having the.
Yeah. And I know some critics, I'll finish this up. I know some critics who are genuinely deeply challenged by it
and
really self-interrogated in a really gorgeous way.
That's so
cool. And I
cool.
feel like, especially like when we did it somewhere like Edinburgh, where, you know, people are living and dying every day on reviews from anyone from like Lynn Gardner in The Guardian to some chump who showed up for free tickets and drink tickets and has never seen theater, but just likes comedy, or, you know, like.
Yeah, right.
So when we were doing it there, I think maybe for all of us, I don't know if I can speak for everyone, but it really did feel like we had actually done something. It felt like we were excavating some kind of space for a lot of younger, queer, female presenting, whatever, experimenters who were like, fuck yeah, thank you. Now I, like, you know, I'm going to keep doing the thing that makes sense to me.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And
great for the whole, that's great for all artists everywhere. I mean, that's a great thing that you did.
It's been a service to all artists
everywhere. But no, I mean, it's good. I mean, that's a really hard thing to think through and be productive about, for God's sakes. And you must have been a hero in certain ways there. Were the other performers like all like they must have been really appreciative.
Yeah, I mean, right? I think there's a certain kind of performer who really knows exactly what we're talking about.
Yeah,
and I think that was maybe a moment of feeling more like an elder in the community. You know, like someone who's been around the tracks for 15 or 20 years.
You're sticking up for your peeps.
Yeah. And it was, you know.
We only have a few minutes left. We've got 6 minutes. This has been so fun. It went so fast. But work is just so fascinating. And I just want to make sure that we get a little peek of what's coming or where your thinking is going. I know you're going to Australia. You're going to be doing a show there. But just like, where are you in your head as far as looking at the future and your work and your creative development?
I'm about to hop on a plane in a few days to go do some work at, show some work at On the Boards in Seattle, this festival of solo work they have next week.
That's exciting.
I'm performing with the Bearded Ladies Cabaret in Wellington, New Zealand, if anyone's going to be there. But
that's cool.
In New York, my ongoing home for like the next project, it tends to be Joe's Pub.
Which is the best place in New York to
perform.
It's amazing. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And where, you know, it's so funny hearing you talk because it seems like you've sort of excavated a lot of your issues with men and misogyny, and now you've excavated some of your issues with, you know, being a theater artist and the critics and stuff like that. And I wonder if you have anything left.
I do. Oh yeah, I do.
Where are you going next?
The next solo
or what's
project
on your head?
I'm working
what's in
on
your head? Yeah.
Is thinking about genius and like how notions of genius or greatness in the arts, like who defined it?
And for fascinating.
I mean, not that I'm interested in being whether or not I
right,
am a
right,
genius,
I get
but
that.
Looking around, I think especially in a post Me Too way of like.
What's your thoughts about that? Do you think men are awarded that? Is it a male female thing? Is it a critic thing? Or where are you coming from?
I think it's pretty unexamined in a lot of ways.
Like who decides who's a genius?
Yeah. What kind of performance? What kind of behavior mm-hmm. is deemed mm-hmm. genius? You know, the narrative of like somehow excusing the behavior of, you know, male geniuses uh-huh. of assuming that their bombastic performances are good.
Uh-huh. Is there any particular example that you could give us of somebody who's considered a genius who might not?
I'm totally blanking on
the
painter
on the spot.
I was reading about, but I was just, you know, there was there was some sentence that I read that was like, God, I can't believe I can't remember who it was.
That's
visual
all right.
Artist.
No, it's because you're right on the spot.
On the spot.
And you
but
only
it was
have
basically like,
two- like
he was in, you know, it was like one of these guys who has like a young female protege who's as talented, but is only understood as a protege,
right.
not an influencer.
Right.
And it was saying something like, he was so committed to his work, he was incapable of performing daily tasks.
Oh.
And I was
Jesus.
Like, I bet he wasn't. I bet he could wipe his own ass. Like, he might not have done the dishes. Like, that, you know, that kind of, like, taking up space and affording people that kind of, like, but I don't know. It just, it seems
gross.
Wildly unexamined for where we are in the world. That, like.
And that's a current, that sounds like Pablo Picasso in the 20s. But no, it's current.
It's current. And, you know.
Oh, that's sad.
People who are, like. I don't know, the whole narrative around anti-heroes and these like sort of assholes we've been taught to watch for hours at a time on screen.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like just grumpy old pains in the ass.
Well,
that
you
are like,
seem
but he never played piano. Who gives a fuck?
Yeah. I mean, I think that one of the, like, it's, I have the feeling that like a lot of your work is actually so on point. And so has so much integrity, really, is because I don't feel like your ego is that involved in it. I feel like it's really you're making work that you are motivated to make for whatever reason. And it's not about like, you know, what people are going to think of you or how much power you can get, what you're going to get out of it.
That's
and I
definitely
think,
not.
I think that's very, folks. This is key. This is what is so rare about Adrian. Seriously, this is very, very rare. And that's why the work is so great. And that's why she is fucking earning a living traveling around the world making this shit. So don't forget about that. Stick around this afternoon. Thanks so much for being
Thanks,
here. I've
Lisa,
enjoyed it
you're
immensely.
Great. Thank you so
and,
much for having me.
So stick around. We've got Lost and Rewound right after this, which is really funny talk, interview, music. And we've got Ben. We've got Ben. Ben Talks. I love Ben. And so much other stuff. And go to radiofreebrooklyn.org.
Dr. Lisa gives a shit.